Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so just on time to we've just half an hour of delay. So I am very happy that Benjamin Pierre Stroffer is presenting the next talk on Dirac-Frankel dynamics with momentum. And you know that Benjamin is a professor at the Courant Institute at New York University, and he is co-authored with somebody from EPFL, which is already a sign because Benjamin will be at EPFL starting in September. Okay, so the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Yvonne, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's really a great honor to speak at this prestigious workshop. I would like to talk about nonlinear model reduction, how we can use nonlinear parametrizations, and especially how to address a non-uniqueness and ill-conditioning issue that sometimes arises in these settings. Before I start, let me acknowledge my collaborator, who is actually from EPFL. He's a PhD student, Matteo Ravioli. He's a PhD student in Fabio Nobile's group, but he visited my group at Courant for 6 months, and he really pushed forward on the work that I'm going to present. So let me set it a little bit in context, what I want to present, and start with our classical motivation that we have heard many times over the last few talks already, namely outer loop applications, motivations for reduced modeling, for complexity reduction, where classical discretization methods lead to too expensive models that we cannot easily use for uncertainty quantification, for control, for inverse problems, optimization problems. But of course, complexity reduction is much, much broader than that, and especially when we want to learn models from data, and we heard about that from that in Andrea's talk, when we want to learn models from data, we are effectively learning reduced models, because it's very rare that the data that we have available comprehensively describes the underlying system. So by definition, we learn a reduced model, and it's helpful to be concrete about that and to be explicit about that. It helps to frame the learning problem. And if you want to make complex decisions that are not just based on one model output of one component, but a system-level type decision that requires coupling multiple components together, again, reduced modeling can be quite useful here to meet certain time constraints, to provide an answer within a certain time frame that is often required to act on that decision. And of course, this decision doesn't have to be a one-way street. It often is actually, again, a loop to update the model, to collect more data, which often is related to digital twins. Now, all of those different types of applications have, of course, different challenges, but I think there are a couple of mathematical computational challenges that really are across these different applications, and one of them are transport-dominated problems, and we heard about them in the previous two talks already, that classical linear approximations are often insufficient for addressing transport-dominated problems, and I think lots of work has been published on that in the last couple of years. Of course, foundations go back much, much longer on nonlinear approximation. There's a second class of problems that I think is quite challenging to reduce, chaotic and turbulent systems, where it's not just enough to be able to approximate transport or convection-dominated behavior. There's more to this, similar to stochastic dynamics, because those type of systems are not meaningful in a point-wise sense. One needs to, in my opinion at least, one needs to look at them from a distributional perspective. And what does it mean to reduce those kind of systems when our states are not an xt in some coordinate system, but our state is a density rho t that changes over time? And finally, overarching over all of that is, of course, how can we learn these models from data? And as I mentioned, Andrea talked about that quite extensively in the last presentation. And learning from data is challenging even in the linear case, but more so, of course, in the nonlinear case. So what I will talk about is really in this category here, and this brings me to my outline. And I first want to briefly recap the Dirac-Frankel dynamics in a very informal way that's sufficient for my purposes, and then discuss an issue that we also heard about in Olga's talk earlier yesterday, what we term the tension space collapse. And this is a non-uniqueness or ill-conditioning issue. And what I will try to convince you is one way to cope with it, not to prevent it, I think it's very hard to prevent it, but one way to cope with it is to use momentum, to use history, and inject that history in a judicious way into the dynamics. Okay, So let me start with, again, it's an informal way of setting up the problem. We have an evolution problem. We have a function u that depends on t. It is in some space at all times t. And we have a right-hand side f that takes that u, and that might also depend on partial derivatives. And we have here the time derivative. And I like to think of the ut also to depend on a spatial coordinate, so we can evaluate it at coordinates in some spatial domain omega. And now in nonlinear model reduction, also in linear model reduction, we have a trial set, or I like to think about it as a manifold, even though we heard already it's not necessarily one. And I denote it with curly V. And then the high-level task is given an initial U hat zero on that curly V. We would like to seek a curve that lives on that curly V that is close to the solution trajectory of the actual problem. So we have here our ambient space. This is curly V. And then we have points on that curly V, which I denote with u hats at some time. So to describe such a curve, we require an initial condition. And then one way to describe the curve is by prescribing time derivatives of that curve. And if you take a point, then all time derivatives of all curves passing through that point lie on this corresponding, I will refer to it as a tangent space. Now, the issue is that we cannot directly use the time derivative that we would like to use, namely plugging in our u hat into just the right-hand side here, because this element most likely will not be in that tangent space. So we cannot directly move in that direction. This is where the Dirac-Frankel variational principle comes in. And it says, let's pick a time derivative, partial du hat, in that space of admissible time derivatives, such that we have kind of a Galerkin condition or a projection. So if we go back to this picture here, we are at this point. This is where the PDE would like to send us, again, in an informal way. We cannot go there because the time derivative is not an admissible one for the curves passing through that point. So one projects it down to the corresponding tangent space. And this is exactly this condition here. And this principle goes back many, many years. I looked at those papers, and probably one can find it somewhere there. For me, more useful is the literature by Christian Lubich and collaborators who view this in the context of dynamic low-rank approximations, for example. Now, this is one way to describe how to determine this time derivative. Another way is via a least squares formulation, right? This is a projection, so we can look at a linear least squares formulation to pick an element v of our set of admissible time derivatives that is closest to where we would like to be, which is the f at u hat. And this is then what we assign as the time derivative to our u hat. Now, this principle or these kind of corresponding dynamics are really widely used in model reduction. They go under different names, so they might have very different names. But in the same principle is applied, for example, by Lee and Kalberg in their 2020 paper, by Schulze and Benjamin Unger in their 2020 paper, where they change modes. There's certainly earlier work. We have work, we call it neural Galerkin, because we applied a neural network and had a Galerkin condition to it. There's work by Bernard Hastung and Silke Klaas and collaborators that build on this principle with symplectic autoencoders. Work by Gianluigi Rosa, Jan Hesthaven, Olga Muller mentioned it yesterday, and many, many other people. So we wrote a survey paper, so let me advertise this at this point, for Acta Numerica, more broadly on nonlinear model reduction, and it just appeared last week. So that gives a little bit a broader picture of that setting. Okay, so this is the starting point for us. And now we would like to work with that scheme. And to work with that scheme, we need parameters. At least I need parameters if I want to compute with something. And again, similar to the setting that Olga presented, I say we have a decoder phi that maps from a p-dimensional vector theta in RP onto a function u hat. This is how we can connect the finite dimensional parameterization to a function. And there are many ways to write down the decoder. One prominent way is neural networks, and I mentioned many people here already. I also want to mention Andrea's group, who is looking at neural networks in a non-intrusive setting. Chabelle Fahatz and Yvonne Mate's work, and many, many other people use neural networks in these settings. But there's also another class that uses, I at least call them fixed feature map representations, of which quadratic manifolds are one instance. They have been around for a little bit in the model reduction community, but at least I really became aware of them with the work from Karen's group and Chabelle's group, and then the nonlinear compressibility work again from Yvonne Matei, Albert Cohen, and collaborators. And when we speak about quadratic systems, I want to also mention Peter Benner's work, because they have done quadratic in all different ways, quadratic systems, quadratic approximations, quadratic everything, and of course they have a whole line of work on that as well. Okay, so we have such a parametrization in some sense now. And this means that, again, in my naive perspective, I would like now to represent my time-dependent function, u hat, with this time-dependent weight or parameter vector theta, think of the neural network weights, that now depend on time, so that I have this connection that I can plug in phi, that I can plug in theta into phi, I get u hat, which depends on theta, which I can abbreviate with just a u hat t. And correspondingly to what I had earlier in terms of functions, we are interested now in determining what the time derivatives are. And for this, let's take the time derivative of this u hat, which now depends on time through this time-dependent parameter theta. And what we see with the chain rule is that we get a Jacobian times theta dot. So I have here the time derivative of the function, and I have here the time derivative of the parameter vector, and I will often call this the parameter velocity, and this equation connects those two perspectives. Now, if you just plug this into the Dirac-Frankel least squares problem, then we get a linear least squares problem that has this structure here, where we have now an optimization problem over eta, which represents theta dot. This is enters here, then times the Jacobian, and this is the time derivative, and we have the right-hand side. And then the theta dot is selected as a solution of that problem. And as you already see by this point, and as you also heard in Olga's talk earlier, there can be an issue in the sense that the map from parameter velocity, so from the time derivative of the parameter vector to the time derivative of the function, that this map has a non-trivial kernel. And this means that there are many different parameter velocities that correspond to the same time derivative of the function. And this is what we call a tension space collapse in this 2024 paper, because, again, intuitively you think of the tension space losing rank. It's not a tension space, of course, anymore, but it's kind of this collapse condition. But it really goes back a long time. The earliest paper that I have found is from 89. They call it a matrix singularity issue and use Dirac-Frankel in computational chemistry settings. Now, you could say, okay, you have multiple parameter velocities that correspond to the same time derivative of the function. Who cares? Just pick one. And we can, in principle, do this, and this least squares problem gives us the possibility to just pick one. But it can run into issues down the line. And this is what I would like to show on this colliding waves example, where I have now two waves. They approach each other, collide, and then separate again. And I represent each wave with a psi function that has a parameter mu, which is the position of that wave. So this is the setting here. This is the spatial domain and the truth solution, and we have these two bumps. If you now parameterize this with a four-dimensional theta, you can already see this is over-parameterized, of course, then we can look at the position and the momentum component. We get here psi plus psi, where theta 1 and theta 2 are the position of the waves, and we get the derivatives here of this psi. And now at collision, when the waves collide, theta 1 and theta 2 are the same, which means their time derivatives are the same, and we are exactly in this losing rank condition, in this tension space collapse. Now, if you select just one velocity, for example, the minimal norm velocity, it's a perfectly fine, and Dirac-Frankel tells us that's a good one, it's as good as any other, then we get a velocity that is orthogonal to the kernel of that map. And this is fatal in that example, because to separate the waves, I need to act exactly in the direction of that kernel. So that while that parameter velocity instantaneously is a good one, down the line it will be bad. And you see this here in this example. This is the truth. This is the Dirac-Frankel minimal norm. And at some point when they collide, it gets stuck. The velocity drops to zero, and it does not move anymore. And you can see this here in the parameters. They move as they should move. Here's the collapse. And then the parameters corresponding to the Dirac-Frankel day, they just are stuck. And this is the condition number of the empirical Jacobian, and it explodes here to double precision, 10 to the 15 or something like this. Okay, so not any parameter velocity is a good one, right? And the Dirac-Frankel variation principle by its version does not directly give us an indication which one to use. So people have looked into various ways of avoiding that issue, that non-uniqueness or ill-conditioning issue. And a big part of that is regularization. So I talked about minimal norm, but you have exactly the same issues with Tikhonov regularization, with truncated SVD. And people have used the regularization in various ways. But I think really the work by Feisch, Lasse, Lubich, and Nick from 2024 analyzed the Dirac-Frankel with Tikhonov regularization in a fairly comprehensive way. Now, this is one way, this regularization, but we saw it picks one velocity, and it's not really clear that this is a good one down the line. Now, one could look at parametrizations that have a full rank map. And work has been done, and this is certainly incomplete here, but there's work, for example, by Boris Kramer's group who look at quadratic manifolds, and you can set up the quadratic manifolds that your Jacobian always has full rank. Then you never run into that issue. But there's other work that is trying to do this, but overall, I would say it's quite challenging to find nonlinear parametrizations that we can reasonably compute with that have that property. And then there are all kinds of non-Dirac-Frankel type dynamics. One work that I know of is again from Caroline Lasse's group from TU Munich. There's work by Andrew Wilson's group. We have some work on discretized and optimized versus optimized and discretized. There are works from the machine learning community called Tang and related schemes. And they all have in common that they replace the Dirac-Frankel dynamics with something else that does not necessarily have that issue. But what they also, and I guess I should also add Olga's new approach to that that you heard about yesterday, but at least the ones that are listed here, what all they have in common is that they exchange the nice linear least square structure of the problem with a full-blown non-convex optimization problem. So at every time step, one has to train a neural network and solve a nonlinear optimization problem, and this can be quite challenging. And finally, there's a whole line of work that tries to randomize, and this can be viewed as kind of another regularization approach, but actually is happening a little bit more than just regularization. I'm happy to chat about that. Okay, well, all of these methods have in common is that they only look at the current time step, t, what to do next. They do not look back. And this is now what we would like to do in the second topic that I want to discuss, namely this gauge momentum work, where we now want to use momentum variables, so history information, to inject something in this null space or in this kernel directions. And this is an ICML. This is this ICML paper with Matteo. Okay, let me rewrite the least squares problem in another way via the normal equations. So we have all the minimizers of the Dirac-Frankel least squares problem can be written as solutions to this linear system, where G is our J transpose J, little g is our right-hand side or force, and eta is again the parameter velocities. And this is a P times P matrix. Now, gauge freedom, what I mean with gauge freedom in the following, is to say that we can take now any reference parameter velocity, any at the bar, any solution to that system, and now we can add any element from the null space of that matrix without changing the corresponding time derivative of the function. Right? All parameter velocities that satisfy the residual minimization property of Dirac-Frankel can be written in this way. And I think this reframes the problem now from oh, there's an issue with non-uniqueness to oh, there's an opportunity to select in a more concrete way an element from that null space that is useful in some sense. And this is where we're heading, that we want to rewrite this problem as saying we have some reference, and now we want to think of an objective L that picks an element of this null space that is useful in some sense. And no matter which one I pick, again, I want to stress that point, no matter which one I pick, I'm not introducing a bias into the dynamics, at least up to first order. So all of those parameter velocities are valid, give me the correct time derivative of the function in stark contrast to, say, Tikhonov of regularization that changes and tilts the dynamics a little bit. At the bar will always be the minimal norm solution for us out of convenience, but it does not really matter which one, because then you just pick a different W here. We will see it in a second. Yeah. Okay, now all the task is choosing an L. And for this, to choose an L, we introduce now a new variable, M, which is in P dimensions. So we have now M and theta. Theta are, say, the neural network weights. And M is now the momentum variable, and it should somehow take the history, the previous parameter velocities into account. And it really should remind you of what the optimizers are doing with momentum. So we have this new variable that we introduced. We also need an equation for it. And for this, we use what's sometimes called Onsager's principle to pick the time derivative of that M dot, or to find an ODE for that M by balancing two terms. One is a cost term, and the other one is a tracking term. Let's look at the tracking term first. I have now the objective curly J, and this curly J is the distance between where my M is, my momentum variable, and where the current reference at the bar is. So if I just would track, then MT would directly be at the bar. But I additionally have this cost factor here now that tells me every change that you make to your M costs you something, and I can control this with this tau here, which then means that this M does not instantaneously flip to be the at the bar, but it can slowly approach the at the bar. And we can control this with this tau. If tau is large, then we put a lot of weight onto the cost and it slowly moves the reference. It takes more history into account. And if the at the bar is small, then it tracks the reference much quicker. We can solve that equation, and it gives us this ODE here. Here's the tau, this is the reference, and now we can write down even the solution to that, right? And I mentioned it's a momentum variable, so what we get is the exponentially weighted history of the reference velocities. This is what MT is, and you see this averaged, exponentially averaged velocity of the reference velocities here. Okay, so we have that M now, and now we can use that M to formulate our L. So we now pick theta dot as the reference plus an element from our null space, where this element W should be aligned with the momentum variable MT plus some regularization on it. And this has been chosen exactly in this way, because if you now look at the solution of the theta dot, we get the reference plus the lambda, this is this lambda here, times the projection of the momentum variable onto the null space of G. So we take the momentum variable, project it onto the null space, scale or dampen it with the lambda, and add it to the theta dot. And this gives now what we call the Dirac-Frankel-Onsager, the DFO dynamics, where we have now a coupled system of ODEs, where we have the M dot, that gives us the momentum and dynamics, and then we have the theta dot that gives us the reference plus this injection into the null space. And now the mechanism is that the tension space can collapse anywhere over your time integration. This means the null space enlarges, and we eject something into this null space based on what we have seen in the history in the momentum variable. And similarly, if you have a poor conditioning result and you truncate nearly singular directions, then again, you inject momentum in those truncated directions, for example. Okay, we can discretize that system, and discretization itself is just implicit Euler. I slightly change the notation to get the beta here instead of the tau, so the beta represents the tau in some sense, and we remain explicit Euler or RK4 or something explicit in the parameter evolution. We get this system here. We have the reference, which is this linear least square solve, minimal norm. We update the momentum variable. This is just vector addition. And then we have this projection onto the null space. And for this projection, we can reuse what when we use the SVD to compute the minimal norm solution, for example. So what I'm trying to say with this is that the cost of that system per time step is, in terms of cost complexity, the same as the standard, say, Tikhonov or unregularized Dirac-Frankel scheme. So there's no
change in the cost complexity does not require you to solve a nonlinear problem. Everything is cheap here. Now, there are two hyperparameters, and I want to be very clear and upfront about them. There's the lambda. The lambda controls the injection strength, so it should be kind of one, and we actually debated whether we want to make it a hyperparameter or not. It sometimes helps to tune it, but you really don't have to. You can just set it to one. And the other one is the beta variable, and this is the history that you want to take into account. It has to be between 0 and 1, so we know the range of it, and you can control how far you want to look back. So there are two parameters, maybe one only if you set lambda always to one, but those parameters are very interpretable. So you can choose them in kind of a reasonable way, and it is not a finicky parameter as in some other neural network trainings that you might come across. Okay, so let me apply this to the wave example. Of course, the wave example is contrived, that it works perfectly here. We have the truth, we have the Dirac-Frankel minimal norm, and this is the DFO, and you see it collapses, and then it separates again. And you see the orange curve, the theta ones over time, are on top of the black ones. Now, what I want to again emphasize is that this is not preventing the collapse, right? It's just coping with it. And this is what we also see here when we look at the condition number from an empirical estimate of the Jacobian. Both collapse, both the rank drops, so the condition number explodes, but because it injects something exactly in those directions, in this null space directions, it can get out of it and it does not get stuck. And this is what we see also in this slide here that just shows the same in a different way. These are the parameters. They cross, here they stuck, here they separate. And here I'm showing the velocities, and this is the truth velocity. Here the velocity drops to 0 in this direction 1 and 2 because it's in the kernel, and here it gets out of it because it injects something. Okay, we can of course apply this to other examples, and we, as I said, we sent it to, we had to do a lot of comparisons for the venue we sent it to, Dirac-Frankel-Tikhonov, Dirac-Frankel truncated SVD, restart, randomized, this tang, this non-Dirac-Frankel type thing. This is a Vlasov equation with a fixed potential in 2D, and we are better in terms of error. So this example should show we don't need this hard collapse condition to improve upon it, but it also helps in moderate cases where other methods in principle work, but you can improve upon a bit if you have this kind of additional knowledge that you use. And you especially see it here in this background information. This is the Dirac-Frankel-Tikhonov regularized. You see this background noise, and it's gone here in the DFO case. Okay. Now, another example where these dynamics are useful is not only for nonlinear model reduction, but for higher dimensional problems. So this is Fokker-Planck in at least 5D. This is the mean prediction, and this is the covariance, or a diagonal element of the covariance. And you see over time, in orange, our prediction, in blue, what Dirac-Frankel-Tikhonov gives, and you see this kind of outliers here. And this we trace down to, again, ill conditioning of the system, and then it just does something strange. There it can recover in this kind of nice systems, but not always, as we have seen in the wave example. And this is this table about the lambda. I said the nominal value is 1, and this shows you for a reasonable range, you get reasonable results. So there's some variation, but it's not a super tricky parameter to choose. Okay, so this is gauge momentum. Here we do not change the Dirac-Frankel dynamics, at least up to first order, and by just injecting something into the null space. Now in this new work that's on an archive, Dirac-Frankel with inertia, we actually change the dynamics. And there we are motivated by how particles move. So let's interpret now our theta, so our neural network weights theta, as a particle that moves in space. The position of the particle is theta t, and the velocity is eta or theta dot, and it is is driven by the force, and this force is exactly our, say, minimal norm solution of the corresponding linear system. So we have here the particle position theta 1, position theta 2, and it moves like this. This is the force that's applied, so this is what we get from our least squares problem. This is the force in direction 1, this is the force in direction 2, and you see I let the force drop to 0 at 1.5, and correspondingly the velocity instantaneously drops to zero as well. This is similar to what we have seen in the wave problem, and this explains this kind of kink here that happens at that time. Now, what we want to do in this work is to say, yes, we have a particle, but we want that particle to have a mass tau, or tau square, and this leads to what's sometimes called heavy ball dynamics. So now the time derivative, the parameter velocity, does not instantaneously, it's not an algebraic equation of the force, but it is its own ODE. And because it has some mass, there's some inertia, and it means that this particle cannot instantaneously change direction where the velocity drops to zero, but it has this smoother behavior. The force drops to zero, but the velocity does not instantaneously go to zero. Now, this changes the dynamics though, right? This would be kind of Dirac Frankel, and you see we are offset here a little bit. So this tau controls how far off we are. Okay, so to describe this, let me recap a little bit the different versions that we have seen. We have kind of the function space version, trying to find a V from that set of all admissible time derivatives. Then we have the parameter space version, trying to find the parameter velocity eta from all admissible parameter velocities. And then we have this Tikhonov regularized Dirac Frankel dynamics, that add this regularizer here to eta, and I denote the corresponding solution now with eta bar epsilon, where the epsilon here is this epsilon, and these are the corresponding dynamics that we have seen already before. Now, if we try to understand what Tikhonov does and what we would like to prevent, we can look at the eigendirections of the system matrix of the normal equations. I denote them with qi. And the sigma i's are the singular values, and the sigma I squares are the eigenvalues. And if I freeze theta for the moment, and now look at what the Tikhonov velocity does in each of those eigendirections, into qi, I get eta bar epsilon I, and in the force gi in direction of qi. Then I can write down this relationship. That's what we have seen earlier, how the velocity depends on the force. And you see here the sigma, and you see here the epsilon, and the force and the parameter velocity. And if you now plug in, instead of the force, the unregularized solution, if you say the singular values are all positive, or at least in those directions, then we get this relationship, which shows that the regularized one, the Tikhonov regularized parameter velocity, is a damped version of the unregularized velocity. So Tikhonov regularization is a shrinkage rule. This is again nothing new and well known, but we see it here as well. What's important interesting for us is that those directions where the singular values are small are damped most, and when the singular values drop to zero, again the velocity drops to zero. I said that already a couple of times. Now we want to prevent that velocity to drop to zero. So instead of trying to find the velocity directly, we want to find the rate of change of the velocity, which is the acceleration. So we have the acceleration, the time derivative of the velocity is the a, and what we can now then, the equation for the theta double dot, we can find a similar way to what we have done before, but now it's not only acting in the null space, it's acting everywhere. So we have our cost factor and our tracking term. And in this tracking term, this is where the Tikhonov objective enters. So we would like to track the Tikhonov regularized parameter velocity, but not instantaneously. And this is what, again, we can control with the tau. And in this case, now we get the heavy ball type dynamics. So we get a second order system for our theta. We have the acceleration, we have the velocity, and we have the force on the right-hand side. And this is the system that we then have. And if we now want to understand how it acts in these different eigendirections, we can first see that it is not an algebraic equation anymore. It is an ODE in each of those directions in which this parameter velocity acts. And the relationship that we get compared to the Tikhonov regularized one is this one here, where we now have again the tau and the sigma I plus epsilon. And now we can distinguish between two types of directions. We can look at well-informed directions, which means the sigma and the epsilon are much larger than our tau, our mass of the particle. Those directions are well informed. There's information available from the instantaneous least squares problem. And then this DFI, this Dirac-Frankel with inertia, tracks those very rapidly, those directions. But in the other directions where, say, sigma is small and correspondingly the tau dominates, there's more mass than there's information. These are weakly informed directions. And in those, then the history dominates. And it follows what it has seen in those directions in the past rather than relying on instantaneous information. And again, in the extreme case, the sigma I drops to zero. It does not instantaneously drop to zero, but fade away in an exponential way. Okay, now with that system, we change the dynamics. And now the corresponding system that we have to solve relies more or less on this map here from parameter position and velocity to the right-hand side of the ODE. And one has to show this as Lipschitz to get existence. And there's no inverse of the G matrix anymore. So we can also set the epsilon to zero, and we still have valid dynamics. Good. We can discretize them again. Standard discretizations, nothing fancy, but I want to point out that I now have the alpha here as my kind of regularization parameter, and I have the beta here that again controls the how far I want to look back into the history. And the key thing, the key point that I want to make is that in the end, what we end up with is again a linear least squares problem that is now anchored in the previous parameter velocity, but it's still a linear least squares problem that one has to solve at each time step. So it's still the same, under quotes, the same cost as just Tikhonov regularized or completely unregularized Dirac-Frankel. Okay, let me show two numerical examples. And the first one is the Allan Kahn example in 1D. So a very simple setup. We use a network with about 1,000 parameters for this. And I'm showing you here the error versus alpha, the regularization parameter. And I'm comparing the Tikhonov regularized TDF and the Dirac-Frankel with inertia in solid. And first you see that there are these U shapes, which is reasonable. If we regularize very little, then it starts to mess up because these directions are not well informed and doesn't really know what to do there. If we regularize a lot, then we over-regularize, and we damp out all the signal that we have that comes from the right-hand side of the PDE. What you can see, though, is that the dashed curves deviate or grow, the error for the dashed curves, the Tikhonov regularized one, grows much quicker with the regularization parameter alpha than the DFI. And let's try this again. And this means, this is also reasonable because, right, you dampen something, nothing happens there, so the error grows. Whereas for the one with inertia, when we dampen more and more, it uses more and more of the history, so the error grows slower than for the Tikhonov case. So this example is not saying one should do one or the other because you can just pick the right, in theory, you can just pick the right regularization parameter. It just shows it's the mechanism that we would like to see. And now we can look at situations where we actually have really weakly informed directions. And one situation where we have this is when we need to set up our empirical Jacobian. Usually we do this via sampling. So we have to choose our xi to xn's in the corresponding spatial domain, compute these derivatives, set up this matrix, and then use the j hat, the empirical estimate in the actual least squares problem. Now, sampling is a challenging question. It's hard to decide where to sample, and to sample enough is expensive because we always have to do these gradient evaluations. So we would like to sample little, and we might even want to sketch the system for the solve because we want to solve small systems. So all those things remove information from the J hat. And so we wanted to see if this inertia helps us to compensate for some of this. And I'm showing you on the top here results for Allan Kahn, and on the bottom here results for Fokker-Planck in 10 dimensions. And we see in both cases error versus the sketch size from the right to the left, from high to low. So left is less information. And again, you can see that the orange curves, the corresponding to Dirac-Frankel with inertia, achieve a little bit of lower error. And especially in the Fokker-Planck case, you can see that the error grows slower than for the Dikunov that just dampens out this information, does not use anything to compensate it. Okay, with that, let me conclude. I think it's important to think about parameter dynamics, and I think there's an agreement on that. The standard Dirac-Frankel can be fine, but it only uses instantaneous information that is too little information to pick a unique parameter velocity. One way to cope with that is using history to fill in this missing information. This is what we try to do here. I think we really have to learn how to cope with it rather than to prevent this tangent space collapse, because I don't see how we can use any off-the-shelf parametrizations without having these kind of issues. And what's at least important for us is that we are not replacing the dynamics with something that's very difficult to or very expensive to compute with, because this is the online phase here, right? We have to do this at every time step. So we really, I really try to stay with this local linear least squares type structure of what we have to do at each time step to not have an explosion of the costs. Okay, so if you're interested in this, as I said, there's this one paper that appeared already at ICML, or actually will appear in 2 weeks or so, and there's this archive preprint, and this is this actinomerical survey article. Thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.